to the 34th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions. For the first time in the history of these confessions, we do not have anybody who is a member of a non-Lutheran church. But regretfully, we have two speakers, one who is from the Wisconsin Synod and the other from the ELCA. If our two guests, are they here? Is Dr. Stephan here? Raise your hand. So you can greet him. He's an external examiner here, and he will be available. He wrote a book that Paul McCain thinks very highly of. As highly as I think of Paul McCain. Now here, I say something complimentary and kind, and all I get is derision from the crowd. And then we have also Dr. Brown. Is he here? Yeah, well, raise your hand. Dr. Brown is from the Wisconsin Synod. If you feel religious, don't do it around him because we have certain... I know the exegetical. I'm still trying to figure out... When I heard Dr. Gard give a lecture on blood, for the Hebrew word is dam, I thought he was maybe... I thought that was forbidden by the second commandment, but we won't push this far. With that, we're going to... Dr. Rass is going to give you a raison d'etre, for the Walther celebration this year. We don't know what it is, so we hope he has something worthwhile to say.
There's a first for everything, so we're hoping. As the planning began for the 34th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions, the choice of the topic was, in some ways, a non-issue. 2011 marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of a man who is unquestionably one of the most important figures in the history of American Lutheranism, Carl Ferdinand Wilhelm Walther. Not since the Walther anniversary of 1987 has choosing a topic been such an easy task for Dr. Scare. Or not. Yet, as was the case on the 100th anniversary of Walther's death, 1987, the question for the symposium organizers was a little bit more subtle. Walther is the topic, of course, but how to approach Walther demanded some careful thought and consideration. We're still waiting for that to happen. At the heart of this symposium, however, is a consideration of the historical circumstances, the theological convictions, and the ongoing impact of a man whom, had he been born in different circumstances, might never have set foot on American soil. Moving is one of the most traumatic and difficult matters that human beings experience, either as individuals or as families. It's unusual to hear of somebody pulling up stakes and moving without giving the whole process some very careful thought. Just take a moment to consider, if you will, the disruption and stress of simply going on vacation. And with that, you know it will be over soon and you'll be back home. But for the founders of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, who left Germany in the middle part of the 19th century for the United States, they did so knowing full well that, as Tom Wolfe says, there's never, you can't go home again. Our Lutheran parents in Prussia, Franconia, and Saxony, Germany, faced difficult times in the early 1800s, conditions really dramatically different from the freedom we enjoy today. The various area governments of Germany established what was allowable in terms of both doctrine and practice, belief and worship. Confessional Lutherans were not free to believe and practice the truth as they had learned it in the scriptures and the Lutheran confessions. Rather, the state defined the limits of their religious expression. Theologically, the dominance of pietism and rationalism made life even more difficult for confessional Lutherans. Pietists and rationalists were not simply willing to allow Lutherans to worship in peace according to their convictions. Rather, they demanded compromise and conformity. As early as 1798, Friedrich Wilhelm III of Prussia began to move toward a union of Lutherans and Reformed. On September 27, 1817, he pronounced that there would be only one evangelical church, one congregation, at his court in Potsdam. Lutherans and Reformed would no longer be allowed to have separate gatherings. Not yet satisfied, though, in 1830 he issued the ultimatum that the name evangelical replace the specific names Lutheran and Reformed. And finally, he mandated the use of a common worship service for all of Prussia in 1834. And the confessional Lutherans resisted, not just in Prussia, but throughout Germany. Did the Lutherans resist because they were a bunch of obstinate Germans? Well, of course. But beyond that, at the heart of their resistance was their deep conviction and confession that resisted unionism, a false unity not based in fact. In Saxony, a group, which of course included C.F.W. Walther, gathered around the evangelical preacher Martin Stephan, who later led the emigration to Perry County in St. Louis in 1838-39. By the late 1830s and early 1840s, Friedrich Winneken was making a Macedonian call from here in northeastern Indiana to Germany for help with taking the gospel to the American frontier. In 1845, August Kramer guided a group of colonists from Franconia to the Saginaw Valley of Michigan, where they could use their freedom to proclaim the gospel to German immigrants and the Native Americans, where they founded the community of Frankenmuth and later added Frankentrost, Frankenlust, and Frankenhilfe. But the story of the struggles of the Germans, who later founded the Missouri Synod, is a story with a point for us, because it shows in vivid pictures the life and death struggle of Christ's church as it faces the temptations of the old evil foe. At the center of this story is C.F.W. Walther, along with gifted colleagues. As their theological heirs, we still face the old evil foe, who means us deadly woe. We can learn a profound lesson from our predecessors in how to proceed in challenging circumstances. For what we face today resembles in striking ways the setting in which the immigrants found themselves. They were tempted to compromise their confessions in order to fit in, as we are. Yet, as we see the way God remained true to them and strengthened them in their confession, we can bank on the promise of God that He'll bless us in the same way. There are two easy paths that we can follow as we begin this symposium. One is simply to uncritically glorify Walther. As Norman Nagel put it some years back, there is a sense in which Walther carries the burden of his own infallibility, which makes a... Only Nagel could come up with something like that. And that makes it difficult for a critical, though not necessarily negative, assessment of Walther's work to occur. To explore more fully Walther's conclusions, the manner in which he reached them, and the way in which circumstances sometimes drove them, leads some to conclude that Walther is being rejected. Not so. That, of course, leads to a second problem, which is an equally simplistic rejection of all things Walther. Before this symposium even occurred, there have been commentators who have prophesied what its results will be. One recent internet post summarily dismissed the entire seminary as anti-Walther. In another case, an unsolicited newsletter informed me that, quoting here, all participants at the symposium will be Walther's apologists rather than be personally objective. Since neither of the individuals writing will be present these next days, we'll have to postpone any stonings should their prophecies prove to be inaccurate. But just remember, Walther will be watching. More to the point, what the next 2 days will offer us is the opportunity to consider Walther, his times, his theology, and his impact. This afternoon, we'll hear about the confessional revival, as well as several leading figures in it who interacted with Walther in significant ways, namely Kleefoot, Grabau, and Lea. Tomorrow, we'll place Walther in the larger American context as Missouri's founder, and see how he interacted with confessional movements here in America, with the Wisconsin Synod, and specifically, how he interacted with Martin Stephan in his early days. Finally, on Friday, we'll turn to Walther's interaction and use of Luther before completing the symposium with the consideration of one of the great disappointments of Walther's life, namely the defection of Eduard Preuss to the Roman Catholic Church. In the past year, this seminary has achieved a significant milestone in its history. For the first time, it received 10-year accreditation from its two overseeing agencies. The actions of the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association and the Association of Theological Schools in granting this status to this school underscore the recognized excellence of its faculty, its Board of Regents, its administration, staff, and especially its students. It shows that Concordia Theological Seminary is a dynamically engaged institution that is fulfilling its mission with excellence. And one of the ways that we do that is to sponsor these symposia. And this particular symposium offers us, I believe, an opportunity for the future to let the real Walther stand up. But beyond that, perhaps it can drive us towards realizing Walther's promise for Lutheranism today. As we now prepare to hear our first lecture, perhaps some words penned by a Fort Wayne pastor some 12 years ago can help frame our consideration and discussion. Quoting, "Perusing Walther's enormous bibliography demonstrates that he still has much to say to 20th, and I would add 21st, century Lutheranism. He wrote eloquently and at length regarding Lutheran Reformed Union, the necessity of remaining a liturgical church, the dangers of the new measures, and on many other contemporary topics, along with, of course, church and office. We need Walther. We need the real Walther. And we need to read Walther critically, according to his own excellent criteria." The Fort Wayne pastor who wrote those words in the January 1999 Concordia Theological Quarterly now happens to be president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I would encourage us to take President Harrison's words to heart as we consider C.F.W. Walther, his times, his theology, and his impact. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 34th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions.